I begin today by acknowledging the Wangal people, traditional custodians of the land on which I am today, and pay my respect to their elders past, present and emerging. Welcome to an episode of From the Lighthouse with Michelle Council. In today's episode, I interview Clémence Michelon, author and award-nominated journalist for The Independent. Clémence was born in France and moved to New York in 2014. And earlier this year, Clémence's first psychological thriller was published, called The Quiet Tenant. I loved reading this book. I could not put it down, and I'm thrilled to have the opportunity to speak with Clémence today and uncover all things regarding The Quiet Tenant. Before we start, we will be discussing various details from the book. And if you haven't read it and don't want spoilers, I recommend reading and then coming back to this podcast later. Now let's get to the interview. Hi Clémence, welcome and thank you for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you so much for having me, Michelle. It's a pleasure to be here.
So Clémence, why don't we start with you telling us all about The Quiet Tenant?
Of course. The Quiet Tenant is the story of a man who has a secret and a problem. His secret is that he's not the upstanding, wonderful man that his community and his small town of upstate New York believes him to be. He is, in fact, a serial killer who has murdered multiple women and who is holding another victim captive in a garden shed on his property. And his problem is that he has to move from this relatively large property to a smaller house that doesn't have a shed. And he decides, or is manipulated into, bringing his victim to live with himself in the new house, where she will also live alongside his teenage daughter, who obviously doesn't know about her father's crimes and is under the impression that this new woman is a tenant who is renting out a spare room from her father. The story is told from three main perspectives, all female perspectives, the captive victim, the teenage daughter, and another woman who's always had a bit of a crush on our male character. And obviously she doesn't know he's a serial killer either, and she's going to try to get closer to him, not realizing what she's about to walk into.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Thank you. And so what inspired you to write a serial killer story?
So this novel started for me in March or April of 2020, which was a very intense, very heightened period of time for all of us, I think. And I happened to spend it in upstate New York in a house with my in-laws and my husband. And what was very interesting is that we all knew what everyone in our little group did for a living, but suddenly we were all together all the time, hour by hour, really. And we could see how we actually spent our days. And my mind wandered and I started thinking, what if someone had a really dark secret that they had been able to keep because of the distance that is baked into our lives and our routines and our schedules, and because we have our jobs and we have our commutes and everyone leaves home during the day and returns at night usually. And what if suddenly that distance was threatened? And I played around with that idea a little bit. There's no pandemic in the book. But it was just this idea of a man, because I thought, well, what's the darkest secret you could keep from your family? And I thought being a serial killer was pretty much top of the list. And then I thought, well, how to materialize that? And so, oh, well, the captive victim on his property is a way to really bring it really close to his home, literally. And that's how I ended up with this narrative of worlds colliding.
That's such an interesting concept. Another aspect of your book, which I found interesting, is that you have three women voicing the story. And I often find serial killer novels are all about the serial killer and the police who solve the crime. And the women they kill are just an ends to a means to create clues. But your writing is a refreshing change to the genre. How did you put together the three women's voices to create such a cohesive narrative?
Well, thank you so much. It was very important to me to tell the story this way. So I didn't always know that there would be three main female voices and then a sprinkling of others on top of that. But I knew from the get-go that the serial character wouldn't get to speak. And that came from a shift I had noticed in the world of true crime, actually. I noticed that the documentaries and the podcasts that I was watching and listening to were shifting their focus away from the perpetrator and making an effort to, a conscious effort to reframe their narratives and to look more at the victims and the people around the perpetrators whose lives were turned upside down. One such documentary was released in early 2020, I believe, and it was called Falling for a Killer, and it was based on a memoir by a woman who had been Ted Bundy's live-in partner for a number of years. And her memoir is called The Phantom Prince, and she published it decades ago, but it was republished around that same time. So we had the memoir and the documentary released at the same time. And the documentary really spent a good amount of time on Ted Bundy's victims, and the partner in question is interviewed, as is her daughter. I believe Ted Bundy's brother is also interviewed in it, and it was such an interesting reframing of a story that, as a true crime consumer, I had heard so many times. But suddenly, it wasn't really the story of Ted Bundy. It was the story of these crimes in the real world, and it affected all these people in these manners, and it felt much more realistic. It was interesting because it was a story I'd heard so many times, and yet I felt like this is how you would hear about it on the news for the first time, right? It just felt much more anchored into the real world, and that had an impact on me. So then I started writing the story of Aiden, the serial killer, in my book, knowing he wouldn't speak. And originally, I was only planning to write one perspective, the one of the captive victim. So she's the one I started out with, and she was a powerful character for me, but her perspective is limited. She only sees the perspective that her captor wants to show her, which is the world in which he is all powerful and has power of life and death over her constantly. And one evening I was walking my dog and I was listening to a party tune from the 90s, not at all. I was not trying to be in the thriller mindset, but suddenly I had an idea. I thought, wow, what if we had another perspective from a woman who doesn't know this guy is a serial killer and is intrigued by him, is bewitched by him, and is going to try to get closer to him and his life, and what impact would it have on the other woman. And so that's how I added her in. And then I thought, well, if she gets to talk, then the daughter should get to talk as well, because she also has information that we don't know. All the family history, she's the only one who's ever seen this man as a father and as a family man. And so the daughter is really someone whose life is closely linked to her father's life. And anything that happens to him is going to have consequences on her. And so I thought, well, it's only fair to also hear from Cecilia, the daughter. And then after I was done with the first draft, I thought, well, something's still missing here in my big puzzle. Because if we hear from the victim that Aiden couldn't kill and the woman who loves him and his daughter, then we should also hear from the women he did kill, because they also have pieces of the story that the other three don't know. And that's how I ended up with my chorus of female perspectives.
Well, I loved this. I loved all of them. And I really loved the voices that of the women we never met that he killed. I just thought they were fantastic. It was such a great angle to bring them in. And like telling their story of their last day, which I thought was fantastic. So it was just such a great addition. And it did really round that story out, because you don't hear these women's voices. And it's empowering for them it's empowering for us to know that there are, these people all have lives, and even if it's fictional, but this happens in reality as well. So I just thought that was a really great add. And the other thing I thought was interesting, because when you read the first victim story, and I love the way you wrote it, you could interpret that until you get to the end, that maybe this is the first time, you know, he's done this and all the rest of it. And you're thinking, oh, it's a young man, first time he's having sex or whatever. And then you know that it's definitely not that. It was really good.
Yes. Thank you very much. Yes. That was intentional. It's some reason that the voice came to me this way, and it was important to me. So that's how we learn that his very first victim whom he kills is a sex worker. And that's often how it goes, right? Killers manage to get away with murder because they target people whose disappearances aren't going to be investigated very, very thoroughly. Because you know, there's a stigma to their lifestyles, and unfairly so. And we know that often in the world of law enforcement, those disappearances tend to fall by the wayside and are not given as much attention or as many resources as the disappearances of people who are in other fields of work, really. And so that was something I wanted to include in the book.
And then you didn't have to explain that again. And as it moved on, there were just different women on different lives. And I just thought that was really, really great. So it was that worked out really well. So how did you create the main characters of your story? You know, are they based on anybody you know? Was Aidan or Emily, Rachel, you know, Cecilia? Do you know who these people were, or did they just come out of your head?
This is such a good way to ask these questions, actually. It's such an interesting way to look at it, because I feel like we never create anything in a vacuum, right? But I'm happy to say that Aidan is no one I know, personally. hopefully.
That you know.
to the best of my knowledge at this current time. With Aidan, he was an interesting character to create, because I wanted him to feel like he could have been real, but I also didn't want him to feel like the fictional avatar of a specific serial killer who would be well known to the public. So I didn't want people to read the book and think, oh, well, he's obviously meant to be so and so. So I started doing something that I thought of as building him from parts. I thought of multiple serial killer cases I'd heard about, and I borrowed or changed some qualities and incorporated them with a host of other qualities that just came from my imagination, right? But for example, I mean, Aidan, I think, has a lot of Ted Bundy in him, just in terms of the archetype of the man who manages to have this double life and is supposedly, you know, a family man and an upstanding citizen, and then turns out to be doing all these gruesome crimes. And of course, all of Aidan's victims are women, and Ted Bundy targeted exclusively women and girls. I thought about Jeffrey Dahmer as well. Jeffrey Dahmer had a background in the military, and we learned that that's also the case for Aidan, so I borrowed this sort of detail. And Jeffrey Dahmer was not the only serial killer I'd heard about who had a background in the military. He was one of a handful. There was another serial killer who was more contemporary to us called Israel Keyes, who was arrested in, I believe, 2012, and he died in prison shortly, a few months afterwards. And he was also someone who had a family, had a job, and then turned out to have been killing people for years secretly. And his case was interesting to me for a number of reasons, but with regards to the novel, he is someone who was doing these crimes in the modern age. So he had to concern himself with DNA and surveillance footage and all that stuff, and cell phones and everything. So in thinking about Aidan and how he committed his crimes, that is a case I had in the back of my mind. Now, the other characters, Rachel, the captive victim, Emily, the love interest, and Cecilia, the daughter, it was a little different creating them, right? Because I didn't have to sort of refer to a body of knowledge about a specific field to create them. Although, I guess, Rachel, I did read about some stories, some real cases of people who were held captive for a number of years, just to sort of try to understand how these things happen and how they unfold, and to the best of my knowledge, trying to hear from people to whom it had happened, right? So, but then also I wanted to give her a life before Aidan. I really wanted, because that's how it would happen in real life, wouldn't it? You would have your own life and you would be headed towards something. And then it seemed to me that these brutal crimes, it would just be like an unspeakable sort of severance, but in a life that already had, a thrust, right? That was moving towards something. And so that's how I ended up giving her this background where she's a student and she has these ambitions and she has her own problems and she has her own traumas. He's not the only thing that's ever happened to her. And that's because it seemed to me that that's how it would happen. Those people are not blank slates when those terrible crimes happen to them. With Emily, she was kind of a human incarnation of my anxious mind. I think all my neuroses distilled into one character. But I think it was very freeing to write someone who's so... Because she obsessively rereads every text she's ever sent. And if someone doesn't reply, she thinks, oh, what have I done wrong? And I think we've all had times where... Maybe not all, but I think a lot of people have had times where they sort of spiral that way and get very very anxious and a little bit paranoid. So that's a lot of where she came from. And then Cecilia, she was very interesting to create. So her chapters were some of the ones for which I had the most trepidation, because teenage girl is a hard register to hit on the page. She had to sound different from the adults, but then sometimes when you're trying to sound young on the page, you can just sound really cringe, you know? It's just not... It can be hard. And so what I did was, first of all, tried to remember what it was like being a 13-year-old girl, because I was one day. So I looked at photos and stuff, you know, of my own adolescence. Very unpleasant process. And then... what I did also was that I reread a French novel that I love called Bonjour Tristesse. It means Hello Sadness. And it's by Françoise Sagan. And it's told from the perspective of a young girl, a teenage girl, who spends one summer in a beach town in France with her father and his two girlfriends. And it's not a thriller, but it has a sense that something tragic is going to happen. Like, throughout the novel, you just don't know what it is. And so it has this undercurrent of menace. And the girl is very perceptive, sometimes more than the adults. But she also reacts like a kid to a lot of things. So she doesn't have the emotional maturity to react properly to things. And the narration is done in a way that really shows these different levels of reading for the story, and so it was really good. So that's a lot of how I shaped Cecilia came from my reading this book again.
That's amazing. And I actually, thinking about it, Cecilia would be one of the hardest ones to write, because like you say, it could really be cringy or she's too old. And even the story that you just talked about, even if there wasn't, I'm not sure how that's the story ends, of course, but the way that Cecilia talks about things, you know, about how this other woman and now there's this other woman in the place, and how, so the other, in the other book, that girl would have had the same kind of thought process, I suppose, these two girlfriends, and like, what does that mean? And yeah, and that all just means more time away from dad, and dad and I should be together. And in Cecilia's case, you know, she's lost her mom and her dad is, you just thought it's the two of them together, and now that this other strange person comes in, and now, you know, who's this other woman that's hanging around from the bar and things. It was, yeah, that's a very, that's really well put together. I like that. The other thing I found with Aiden is that I love to read and you get a picture of someone in your head and this is who it is, and not always is it Brad Pitt, but sometimes it is. But I didn't get any feeling of who Aiden was, except the only thing that comes through to me in the story is his hands. It seems to always be about his hands. It's the way you've written lots of parts of him, you know, the grips of his fingers and the palm on his neck, on your neck, and he wraps his hands around, his hands go still, and you go, oh, okay. That to me was a really good description of who this man probably is. So anger through the hands.
Yeah, thank you for noticing that. Yes, I felt like in the context of a man who is a serial killer, I feel like his hands hold his secrets, right? They know they're the ones that have done everything. And I felt like Rachel would keep an eye on his hands, right? That's how he's going to hurt her, if he's going to hurt her. So that was... and also, hands betray us a lot, right? If we're nervous or if we're angry or if we're hiding something. So the idea also that they can reveal secrets.
Yes, yeah. And I think that was his only secret. I assume he didn't drink also because if he was concerned that he would tell his secrets if he was so he was it kept everything else more bottled inside him as well.
I made Aiden sober because originally for me it was because I was actually reading about a lot of serial killers who had drinking problems, who would drink a lot. And I wanted to make Aiden a little different. And I thought, well, what if he's sober? And then I figured, why is he sober? And I thought, well, if I had a massive secret, I'd be worried, you know, about getting tipsy and slipping, saying something I might regret. And if it's when it's something of that magnitude, I think it's a very valid concern. So you're exactly right. That's why he's sober.
Yeah. And I think that, and because you, and I know the other thing is, one of the other lines, oh, I love so many lines in the book, and that's what I just loved about the writing. It was just so descriptive. I loved it. And I think one of the lines you have is, this is about him, because it always is. It's never about the woman or what's happening. It's all about him. She goes, this is about him and the things boiling in his head. It isn't about you. And I thought, yeah, because his head must be on fire. These guys who have to feel that they need to live this kind of lifestyle, like, yeah, it's you. How do you keep it all compartmentalized? We all do that, but we're not trying to hide murders. You know, we've got little boxes in our brains for this and that, but yeah, crazy.
Yeah, there seems to be, when you look at stories of serial killers, it just seems to be such a, like you said, yeah, it's just a complete sort of fire in there. There's the cruelty and the violence, and it just seems like a total collapse of mental infrastructure, right? Like all the pieces that hold us together seem to be all in the wrong order, and it just seems like a place of complete torment. I remember reading about Ted Bundy and how he was trying to go to law school or to be in law school, but he couldn't hack it as a law student because I think he was too disturbed mentally, right? To apply himself to a rigorous academic course. And I don't know if we often think about that. If we really think really well about that dysfunction. So that was something I wanted to point out.
Yeah. No. That it was very good, in that part. Now the other thing I want to talk about too is, what I'm really fascinated about your story is about what you left out of it, the acts of violence, particularly that were probably on a nightly basis to Rachel in the house and in the shed. And so my thought was, how did you choose what to write in and what to leave out?
Yeah, so when I started writing this novel, I actually had a lot of apprehensions about this part. I knew this was a book that would involve a lot of violence. It's a serial killer story. And there's a lot of sexual violence as well from the first page. And I knew that was a bit of an ask of the reader to start out this way. And so I was just really worried about how I would address that on the page. But then as I was writing the novel, I found that my own threshold for this kind of violence was actually very clear to myself, and I ended up having a pretty intuitive sense of where I was prepared to go and where I needed to stop. And there is no draft where those scenes are more detailed, everyone has their own process. You know, some writers might need to do more exploratory drafts and then decide for themselves, take some things back. That's absolutely fine. But for myself, it was almost like a place where I couldn't go. And I stopped pretty naturally where I ended up in the final draft, the final version. I think it came partly for me from my work as a journalist. I'm a journalist for my day job, and I cover true crime, and I've spoken to people to whom terrible violence has happened. In speaking to them, I always had a very clear sense of what I was never going to ask. And, you know, we're never talking about those kinds of details. We're never talking about how things happen.
unless someone really, if someone really wanted to make a specific point, or if it felt healing to them to mention something. But I'm never going to ask that question. I'm never going to press for details, because I'm not in the business of re-traumatizing people. And I don't think that's really what matters. I think what matters is the impact it has on people, and what we do with that trauma, and how people carry on later, and what we do with our own traumas, big and small, societal and individual, and what we do with the traumas of others. And so those elements for me came through on the page. So when I was working on those chapters, it was more, what's the impact psychologically on Rachel? What has it done to her psyche? And what does she need to work through as the novel progresses?
And what does she need to do to keep surviving? And I agree with that. I don't think it's a thing we don't need to know. I think some writers, I've read a lot of books and they're so graphic, and it's like, does this really happen anyway? And where I take where my imagination is of maybe what's happening is totally different to a younger person's or an older person. It depends on what their life is. And I think that's also keeps more people intrigued in the story without feeling that they have to be so confronted by, you know, the fact that there's a serial killer killing people. That's pretty confronting. That's all we really need to be dealing with. So, yeah. I also love Rachel's survival rules for inside and outside the shed. I liked how it kind of gave a great ending to chapters. It's like your page turner. What is that? What you did it for was kind of enticing the reader to keep turning the page to the next section.
It was I think they kind of came to me pretty naturally. Well, at first I found rule number one, because that seemed like a good way to end this chapter, and then I thought, well, I should probably have other rules than if there's a rule number one. But it was kind of a way to impart the fact that she has been captive for 5 years without having to repeat all the time, 5 years, 5 years, 5 years. It would have impacted her psyche. She would have developed almost a code of personal conduct. And it's a way to have these little bits of insights sometimes about why a chapter unfolded the way it just did, right? Like, it just gives us her mindset, and then they change as they go, because then she has to figure out how to survive outside the shed, and those are new rules that she's making up as she goes along. So it seemed to me like it was a good insight in her mind as a survivor.
Definitely was. And you can see as she gets further along, they do become more loose, because she realizes that the control that he says he has, he doesn't have as much that control, because she's now in a different environment. I thought that worked really well too. And I just love going, oh, good, here's the new rule. I thought that was really great. And the other thing in there, there's the three books that Aiden gives her to read, which is, you know, because obviously when she doesn't have very many things. Are they favorites of yours? Is that how you chose the three books, or?
Yes and no. So, I mean, there's no book that I dislike in there. Love all books. But let's see. Loves Music, Loves to Dance, definitely a favorite of mine. All the books are Easter eggs in a way. So Loves Music, Loves to Dance by Mary Higgins Clark is a favorite of mine, and it was one of the first thrillers I ever read. My mom had it on her nightstand, and it was her French edition, because I'm French, and I actually have it on my shelf right now. I can see the cover from here, and the cover is very arresting. I remember I thought I was being really smart. I read straight to the end, because I figured, well, that's the most interesting part of any thriller. Of course, you don't understand anything if you just read the ending. Does it really? So that was the first big lesson. It's all about the buildup. So then I reread a little bit more from the beginning, and when I got to the end, the ending of that book is absolutely terrifying. It's amazing. It's an amazing thriller, and I was just blown away by it. So I decided to use it in this novel, It by Stephen King, because I love Stephen King, and also there's also an Easter egg there, which is that. How do I not spoil something? At one point in the novel, at one point in the novel, that copy of It is used to do something that echoes something that is done in Misery by Stephen King.
Let's just say that. So that was a little reference because I was reading Misery when I was working on the revisions for The Quiet Tenant. And then we have A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, if I remember my own book correctly. That's book number three. And A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, I actually have yet to read it, but I remember it entered my conscience when I moved to the U.S. in 2014. I realized that it's really considered kind of a classic here. Like, my understanding is it is a novel you'd be assigned to read in school, and kind of everyone has read it, but I'd never heard of it before. And not every book is like this, right? Like A Catcher in the Rye, I'd heard about it in France. I had read it in French. But for some reason, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn had escaped my attention, and maybe it was just my particular experience, but it was symbolic of my discovery that there are these whole pockets of American culture that I still didn't know when I moved here, and my attempts to wrap my brain around them and to learn everything I had still to learn. So that's how I made this trio. And also, it felt like a book that someone would have with them, right? It just felt like a book that would be around.
Yes. And the other one would be like A To Kill a Mockingbird, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They're in those classic ranges of books that someone's always got it. Mum had it or dad had it. It's in the bookcase or whatever.
Right, so, right. Those modern classics. Yeah. Sort of everyone has them in the library. Yeah. A classic.
Yeah. Okay. A classic. That's it. Classics. Yeah. And so I'd love to now talk about your publishing process, if that's okay.
Of course.
When did you start reaching out to for this? Did you do it with a synopsis? Had you written the book and then started searching? Like, how does it all happen?
So with
inquiring minds.
Yes. So with fiction, you need a complete manuscript before mm-hmm. you start querying agents. So I wrote the first draft of The Quiet Tenant in 6 months, and then I revised it for 6 more months before I felt like I could show it to somebody. And I knew one agent personally because he was a friend's agent, and I had interviewed him for a piece that I had written about publishing, and we had kept in touch. And I knew the odds were quite low that the one agent I knew would become my agent. So I was like, I don't want to be like presumptuous here. So I was prepared. I was really prepared for him to politely pass, and I had a list of other agents I might query if he said no, and I sent him a proper query letter. It was very important for me to get in touch professionally, you know, just to sort of do things right. And then I was the luckiest I've ever been, because he read the novel fast, and he took me on as a client, and he's my agent. And he's amazing. So then we made a couple of changes to the manuscript. Nothing too extensive, but, you know, some agents are very very editorial minded, and most of them will have notes on a project before to make sure it's ready to send out on submission. And then we went out on submission to publishers, and The Quiet Tenant ended up selling to Knopf at auction, and that was my little fairy tale, really. It was really great.
It's fantastic.
Yeah, I was very lucky. And then after, we had a wave of interest from foreign publishers, so it has sold in, I think it's now 31 foreign territories. It sounds ridiculous that I don't recall exactly, but I'm so tired.
You say like you took 6 months to write the book, 6 months to rewrite before you thought it was great to go out. That sounds about right, I suppose. But then it doesn't really end there, does it? Because then you rewrites and you re-edits, and then I saw something the other day. You were talking about it's getting translated into French, and that words aren't the same. So it's kind of a rewriting again, I suppose, or re-editing to make it work in each of these different countries.
Oh, you're absolutely right. First of all, it certainly doesn't end with, you know, the version I had ready to send out to the man who became my agent, and then the version we sent out on submission to publishers. Then with Knopf, I was in edits for a few more months, and we did 2 big rounds of revision on this novel, so like with my editor. And then there's copy edits, So that's really the like line level stuff. And then there's first pass pages where everything is set like it's going to be on the page. And then there's second pass pages, which is really last call, last typo, last anything. So when people ask me how many drafts there were for this book, I have no idea. I usually like, I'm like, I don't know, 15? 15 sounds about right, but I don't know because, you know, with one round of edits, I would still reread it from the onset and change things as I went. It's just, so you're absolutely right, it never stops. And then working on the French translation has been very interesting because I have a wonderful translator. Her name is Natalie. And so I'm not translating it myself from scratch, but I do have an opportunity to read the French translation and give notes if I have them. And I am so grateful for translators because it is an art, and it's not an art that I'm well-versed in. And it's so humbling to see that just because I speak both languages doesn't mean I'm equipped to be a translator. And it's every time I do a bit of the French translation, my little notes, I do it for an hour and then I need to go lie down. It really takes it out of me. It's really hard.
So and let him do the work.
It's, oh my goodness, it's so hard. Yes, it's very much, it's still, it's interesting. I didn't think I would get to still revisit this novel on the page again, but I do.
Mm. So do you still feel then that you're really still involved with this novel? I mean, have you been able to free your mind on what's happening next in your life? Or is that like, you're still like at base camp with this guy?
I have been able to sort of turn my mind to other projects, but it was a process. Let me tell you, it was very interesting when I finished working on The Quiet Tenant and it was time to kind of, you know, move on, right? It was just going to get printed. And I mean, first of all, there is a process with the publication and talking about it with readers where you feel like it's getting shared and now it's over to the readers and all of that. But for a little while, between the moment when I was done working on it on the page and before publication, I really had this feeling of, I don't know what I'm going to do if I can't hang out with these people every day. I'd gotten to know them so intimately. And I think also because it was at a time where we weren't traveling or doing much of anything in person, right? 2020, 2021. This world had really become my world. I had spent a lot of time in it. And so it felt really, it was a bit of a transition there. But time does everything.
Of course. And I think the next thing will be interesting to see next time when you're writing again, how long do your friends stay with you, you know? And is it an easier, as you go along, is it easier to say goodbye and move on and pick up the next creation? So
I do wonder about that. I do wonder, you know, it's awkward at first, the transition, because it's a little unfair to the new characters too, because you're leaving these people you know really well. By the end of this process, when you've read the novel 55 times and you've done 15 drafts and everything, you really know them intimately. And then you have to move on to these new characters and you don't know anything about them and they're all awkward and you're like, oh, why can't I go back with the other ones, you know? It's tough. It's tough.
And they're like, give us a chance. Just give us a chance.
Yeah. Well, and it's very... it's also unfair because, you know, you're moving away from a draft that you've worked and reworked, so it's pretty polished, hopefully. And then it's just brand new thing, you know? But you got to give it a chance. You got to give yourself a chance. You got to give your new project a chance.
Do you have a writing routine? People talk about their routine. They have breakfast and they walk the dog and then they type till lunch and then they, you know. Do you have anything you follow in particular?
I'm not so organized. Actually, I should say, The Quiet Tenant was actually a novel I wrote with a pretty steady routine, but I think that was more a result of the state of the world at the time and my life at the time. I didn't really, you know, my days had sort of a baked-in structure because I work as a journalist from 9 to 5:30, and so I would write an hour before that and start at 8, and then, you know, when work was done, I would then go back and do more work on the novel. And then on weekends, I would go back and and reread a little bit, but mainly I really didn't do that too much for this one. I really sort of try to move forward. So if I reread bits, it was more to like remind myself of what I had written and make sure everything was vaguely coherent. Just moving forward with the story. I do have one thing. I'm a word count girl. So especially with the first draft, the only way I can get through a first draft is by having a word count that I try to hit daily if possible, ideally 7 days a week. And usually I'm having fun, so it's not too hard to hit 7 days a week. And then if I can't do it one day, it's absolutely not a problem, right? Because even 6 days a week is already pretty good. And the word count I personally use is between 500 and 1,000 words. Because I tried to have 1,000 words every day as my goal, and that didn't work because that takes me a couple of hours to do. So if I didn't have 2 hours, I would write 0 word. But so having this, and you know, then 500 words, it can be a little limiting because sometimes you'll have a little bit of fuel to go further. So for me, having that flexibility, I get to feel like I accomplished my goal anywhere from 500 to 1,000 words. That's really a way that it just doesn't feel like a bummer, right? It's just, I always get to feel good. But nowadays, with life having started up again, and my weekends are busy and my days are busy, I kind of write when I can. And sometimes it'll be the morning before work, and sometimes it'll be the evening after work. And that's okay. And I've noticed if I write in the morning, my brain is a little different than in the evening, so the writing's a little different. It can be interesting to play with that. Sometimes it'll be on my lunch break. Sometimes it'll be on my weekends. Sometimes it'll be on the notes app on my phone when I have 10 minutes. I'm a big believer when it comes to first drafts in lowering your standards.
I love getting it done.
And then you'll make everything better afterwards, right? Like, I always feel, for me, the first draft is the hard part. I always feel like it's going to collapse at my feet. I'm going to realize there's a terrible fatal flaw I hadn't thought about. So I just need to finish the first draft. And then is when I start having fun, because I feel like I have built myself this new toy and I can make it better. I can actually make sure it sounds good, and I can have my characters try on different things, and it's kind of fun. So that's really the only consistent part of my process has been the word count.
Okay. And actually, I love that as a concept, because 500 words, I mean, you know, if you're studying, I mean, that's a couple of paragraphs, really, if you really put it together sometimes. I think it's fantastic. And to 1,000 words, you go, okay, now I'm done for the day. Instead of going, I've got to keep sitting here and looking, and what am I going to do, and how far does it go? That's great. I'm going to take that one on. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're so welcome. I think it's really important to make it rewarding, right? Like I think it's so terrible if you have this high word count goal and you just day in and day out, you're not going to reach it. What a terrible feeling it is to sit down and work and never feel like it's enough. It's heartbreaking. Mm. But that's what I like with the flexible word count. And you know, if the word count needs to be lower at first, like, that's fine. Because if you write like even 200 words a day, you're going to get a first draft eventually, right? It's the trick for me is that even 500 words, it doesn't always feel like it's enough to amount to anything that could be life-changing, but it is, because the trick is in the consistency.
And I think that also maybe helps you that the age-old problem of writer's block, because if you don't feel like you have to be changed this thing all day long, then you're not going to have that thing where you're sitting there looking at a blank screen and you go, I've only got to do 200 words, 500 words or whatever, and I think that helps. Did you get writer's block at all while you were doing this, or were you... You didn't because of your program?
Yeah, I didn't get writer's block. I had a million anxieties. I had a million conversations with my husband and with friends about this plot point and this and that. But I didn't have writer's block. And I do think there is a way with this word count that it sort of makes it less daunting. Right? It's just I have to write 500 words. Okay.
Yeah. I don't have to write the whole novel. Yeah.
Right. I don't have to solve everything. I can, you know, some problems will be dealt with next week. It's okay. And then you know it's going to happen, you know, so it gives you time also to start working out things. So I really am a believer in it.
So what's next for you? Are you writing a new novel, or you're putting the bones together, or what's happening?
Well, my goal was to have finished writing something new before The Quiet Tenant came out. And at 11:50 p.m. before the day of release for The Quiet Tenant, I sent my agent a completed draft of something new. It is also a psychological thriller. I think that's about it. Yes.
Well, we look forward to seeing more about that. That's great. Well, Clemence, thank you so much for your time today. You've been really generous with it. And it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. And I hope that maybe we can talk again when your next book comes out.
Oh, well, thank you so much. Thank you for your kind words. Thank you for having me. Thank you for reading the novel so generously. Thank you for the great questions. This was really, really wonderful.
Thank you for listening today. That's it from The Lighthouse for now. Please remember to like us wherever you listen to podcasts.